VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 340, recorded on February 2nd, 2014.
And welcome to the 340th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 73rd episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
I am Jordan Lund.
And I am Jonah Fowle.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and includes gaming flashback and gaming history.
VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 340, recorded on February 2nd, 2014.
Hello, and welcome to the 340th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 173rd episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
I am Jordan Lund.
And I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry, including gaming feedback and game history.
VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 340, recorded on February 2nd, 2014.
Are we really doing this three times, or am I just... I'm freaked out because I downgraded my Skype, and I don't know if it's misbehaving or if we're actually doing this three times.
Well, I don't know what was wrong with the second take.
Well, you botched it, but you know what today
gaming
is.
Feedback.
What is today?
Oh, I see. It's Groundhog Day.
Yes.
You got me.
Yeah.
You got me. Waka waka.
Don't mess with the guy running new software, man. Seriously.
There's no such thing as a lag that bad. Why would it repeat that much?
Are you kidding? I can't even see straight.
Yeah.
But we'll get better.
You had complained that I have lag, so what I did is I ditched the Windows 8 version of Skype and I downgraded to Skype 5 or something like that.
There you just...
Yes, but when we said you had lag, we were talking about your wardrobe.
You know, I love you. I argue sweatpants never go out of style, really.
This is true.
You know.
This is true. They do need to be washed occasionally, though.
They do, yeah.
Anyway, this episode, we actually do have a gaming flashback and a game history because it's about time for it. And especially since it's 2014, I'm able to go a little bit forward in time. And, you know, 2004 had a lot of major games, and I know that... One of Jordan's favorite games was in 2004. It begins with an H and ends with a 2. But, or was it? Wait.
Home Alone 2 for the NES?
Wait, was
Home
Halo
Alone 2 was awesome.
Was Halo 2 your one of your favorite games, Jordan?
No, I actually hated Halo 2 because of the ending.
Oh.
Mm.
Yeah. But we do have another 2 as our gaming flashback, and this one's a bit controversial. Well, I don't know if it's controversial. More like disappointing, even though it was fulfilling at the same time.
Yeah, it's like bad pizza.
Is there such a thing as bad pizza, but still fulfilling.
Oh, you said fulfilling.
Okay. Anyways, Jordan, go ahead. Take it away.
So, gaming flashback, Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic 2, The Sith Lords. Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic 2, The Sith Lords is a role-playing game released for the Xbox and Microsoft Windows. It is the sequel to Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, and it was released for Xbox on December 6th, 2004, while the Windows version was released on February 8th, 2005. It was developed by Obsidian Entertainment and published by LucasArts. The game takes place 5 years after the events of Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, in a time when the Jedi have been nearly exterminated by the Sith. The player's character, a former Jedi Knight exiled from the Jedi Order, is referred to as the Exile, or Jedi Exile, and was later named Mitra Surik in the Old Republic novels. Throughout the game, the player's character, canonically a female, although the player can choose to play either sex, restores their connection to the Force while, with the help of a non-player character companions, trying to stop the Sith. The player makes choices that turn the exile into either the light side or the dark side of the Force and travels to six planets to either help or hinder the Republic's efforts to bring peace and stability to the galaxy. Among the characters who join the Jedi Exile are Kreia, who acts as the Exile's mentor, pilot and former Sith assassin Alton Rand, technician and Mandalorian war veteran Bao Dur, and his droid Remote, the criminal droid G0T0, and the Sith apprentice Visas Mar. T3-M4 and Candrus Ordo, now identified as Mandalore, both featured in the first game, also join the Exiles team. Other characters join the Exiles party only under certain conditions. HK-47, who appears in the first game, joins the quest if the Exile collects and uses the parts necessary to reactivate it. The Wookiee bounty hunter Hanhar joins if the Exile is aligned with the dark side of the Force. Hanhar's competitor Mira joins the Exile if the Exile is light aligned or neutral. If the player's character is male, Brianna the Handmaiden can join the player's quest, while Michael the Disciple joins a female exile. The Sith Lords was constructed using an updated version of Knights of the Old Republic's Odyssey game engine, which Obsidian obtained from BioWare Company. BioWare also provided technical assistance to Obsidian's developers. New features include more combat animations and interface scaling. Producer Chris Avellone, in an interview after the game's publication, stated that he wished, quote, there had been more time to work on the game, and that a large amount of content, a droid factory, an entire planet, and other locations were cut. There are four official patches for the game. The second and third patch updated the quality of the movies and music, while the first and fourth fixed gameplay issues. In 2005, after an end of the official support, the game community began to provide support themselves. A fan-released unofficial patch by this modding community fixed around 500 remaining bugs and also restored most of the cut content back into the game. There were also methods found by the community for improving compatibility and implementing widescreen functionality on modern PC operating systems. The game was generally well received by critics. Metacritic gave the game an average rating of 85 out of 100, compared to 93 for Knights of the Old Republic. GameSpy called Kreia the best character of 2005. However, the game was criticized for being incomplete due to a rushed deadline.
It was Kreia.
So was it anyways, Kreia?
Yeah, I mean, I have it on my on the Xbox, but I also bought it on Steam so that I could try the cut content. But unfortunately, the problem with the game is that it's one of those games, if you don't build your character right, you can get to a point in which no matter what you do, you're not properly built to progress further, and it becomes impossible to play. So I have to start over again, which is fine, because I haven't played for months. I'm going to probably start playing again. And the thing is that this game, you know, for the first two-thirds of the game, it's entrancing. One of the gameplay improvements was that, unlike the first game, your companions, they would change their alignment along with you. If they liked you and they were bonded to you, they would go in the same direction. If they didn't like you, if they hated you, they would go in the opposite direction, right? So it's like the hand.
I remember that with HK-47 always being dark sided, no matter what I did, you know. And I always played a light sided character. He really did not like that at all.
Well, the thing is, he never really. The other thing is, even if he cheated and you're able to stay light side while pleasing him, is that you could that was impossible, because anything you did that was light sided would displease him. Or if he wasn't in the party, see, that's one way you could trick it. Is have them out of the party and do things, and they wouldn't react.
Right.
The thing that is that Kreia would remain neutral no matter what you did.
Gotcha.
During the game, you know, even if she liked you a lot. As a matter of fact, if she really liked you at the end of the game, and it's not a spoiler to say she's the end game boss, she'll still say that she loves you. You know, even as you're defeating her. And Kreia is such a great character.
Yes. I enjoyed the game. I don't really recall, as I played it, feeling anything was missing. I mean, I found out after the fact that
stuff. But when you go into Malachor 5, the very last, couldn't you tell? There was a lot of stuff going on which would then go nowhere. Like Goto would attack Beodur's droid, and nothing would ever come of it. You know, you never found out what happened to other people. I found it hard.
Well, to you know, a lot of that stuff, you know, I don't recall being very different from the first game.
I mean, I didn't notice a missing, say, of the droid factory.
Right.
But I could tell that it was a rush job at the end. It was just so palpable. And it's a pity because, you know, I liked the gameplay mechanics in this story a lot better than Knights of the Republic. The guy that they wrote the story, he said he read every single book, comic, and movie in the Star Wars universe.
Whoa.
And what he did was he tore it to pieces. He deconstructed it.
Yeah.
You know, like...
That's the man with too much time on his hands.
Well, the thing is that one of the fun things that pointed out was, do you notice how you keep on getting strong every time you defeat people? You know, they
I noticed that. Yeah.
You know, it's because of this, but it's like, yeah, that's a standard RPG trope, you know?
Right. Leveling up.
And they also, I can tell why Lucas wasn't very pleased with this game, is that they tear the hell out of the Force. You know, they deconstruct it and mock it, and, you know, and she does such a great job of doing that. You know, basically asking, you know, the reason why I love you is because you're removing the Force from the world, and I think it would be a better place without it.
Well, you know, as long as there's no midichlorians or anything.
No, George Lucas wants the midichlorians in there. Anyways, we're going to move on to game news. Now, we have a follow-up to last week's news when Sony was teasing the slimmest announcement of the year.
Okay. The slimmest announcement, yes.
All right, so follow-up. PS Vita Slim to launch in the UK, and this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. The PlayStation The PlayStation Vita Slim will launch in the UK on February 7th at the price of around £180. The Vita Slim swaps the original model's excellent OLED screen for a less impressive 960 by 544 IPS LCD display. However, it benefits from being 20% thinner, 15% lighter, and has improved battery life. The 180 price point is also lower than the launch price of the original Vita. Pre-orders for the PS Vita PCH 2000 opened today. So, you said that you were not interested in the Slim.
No, I'm not interested. I have a perfectly functional Vita, so I don't see the need to buy a new one.
Do you find it interesting that they're only selling it in the UK?
I did think it's strange that they only announced it in the UK. But, you know, the one piece that's kind of missing from this is that Sony had a big general purpose electronics event a couple of days before. So I think this kind of went hand in hand with their European strategy. So it doesn't surprise me they didn't announce an American release. We will see an American launch at some point. There will be some big announcement, and then the Vita will go on sale the week after, just like they're doing about a 7-day period here. Probably at E3, there will be an announcement, and then the Vita 2000 will go on sale 7 days later.
Yeah, it's just an upgrade to an existing piece of technology. I'm not really that interested.
I have to wonder though, Paul. Maybe do you think they're releasing it in the UK as sort of like a test market?
That wouldn't surprise me, but I really can't. I mean, PS Vita sales haven't ever really been that stellar,
well, right?
No, because as Jordan keeps complaining, they don't really have exclusive games.
Yeah, they need to do like a full relaunch with new system titles and everything if they want it to catch on.
But what about the TV Vita? Vita TV or whatever that thing is
the
called.
The Vita TV could be a cool thing. I think we'll see more. What they need to do with the Vita TV is they need to get it off the ground in Japan with support for the DualShock 4, which we won't see until they actually launch the PlayStation 4 in Japan. But, you know, that's supposed to be a firmware update that the Vita TV will recognize the DualShock 4 and make the Vita games more playable on the Vita TV. That might have an impact. And then, of course, they need to announce the Vita TV outside Japan, which they still have not done yet.
Okay. next, Jordan, why don't you take this one?
Reports, Microsoft plans cheaper disc-free white Xbox Ones in 2014. This comes to us from Ars Technica. VG247 has confirmed with a well-respected senior publishing source that a cheaper version of the Xbox One is coming sometime this year. That means a new model for the hardware, not just a price reduction on the existing $499 configuration for the system. NeoGAF's NTKML, whom longtime forum moderator Bishop
TL... I think it's NTKernel there.
NTKernel could be, yeah, NTKernel, whose longtime forum moderator Bishop TL has cleared as a reliable source with ties to internal Microsoft information and private communications, claims Microsoft is looking into a disk drive free version of the Xbox One. That follows reports from earlier this month that the company was considering releasing a disk free Xbox One as late as June of 2013. The Verge also confirmed reports that Microsoft will be releasing a white edition of the console, matching the previous employees only exclusive white model, later this year, that a major dashboard update is coming to the system in March, and that an Xbox One with a 1 terabyte hard drive is being prepared for a November release. Over at NeoGAF, NT Kernel has offered up many more nuggets of information that have yet to be verified by additional sources. Those include a 1080p anniversary remake of Halo 2 in November, which will include access to a Halo 5 beta, DLC for Titanfall coming as soon as 45 days after launch, a 2015 release for Fable Legends, and a detailed list of launch dates for the Xbox One in various countries. Whether all those things come to pass or not, Microsoft doesn't seem happy with this information being leaked. Kotaku reports that one person familiar with the situation said that Microsoft is trying to track down and, quote, looking to take legal action against the leaker.
Yeah, dun, by dun, the way, just new news is that Microsoft has denied all this. But the thing is that I think I might have gone for... Maybe not, but, you know, the thing is that this is something that Sony wanted to do with the PSP Go, and that is have a device that did not require any disk drive at all, you know? And the thing is, neither Sony nor Microsoft included CD support, right?
Right.
And they're including Blu-ray support almost grudgingly because they need discs so they could please GameStop, you know?
Right.
So I'm wondering if this is the... You know, if this is the first shot, this could be the first shot fired in having a disc, you know, in not having discs at all for, you know, having just a pure online hard drive digital library.
You know, I've said it before, and I don't think anything has changed my mind, but really, the market just is not ready for discless gaming exclusively.
Well, PC gamers more or less are now.
But not the entire market. Not when it comes to console sales. I'm sorry. It's just people who are in that particular genre of gaming want to have the tangible item, because you're absolutely right. There's an entire second sale market that needs to be supported. There's an old school mentality of having your cartridges, and things never, you know, things were made to never break. So it's like, I still have my original copy of Zelda. People who are hardcore into gaming to still be into console games at this point don't want to part with their games.
Well, I mean, with cartridges, you know, you didn't have to worry about dirty disc errors, really. I mean, with Assassin's Creed 4 already, you know, I think I'm having my Xbox One drive is having trouble recognizing the disc. I mean, it's not having trouble with other games.
Is that a problem with the disc or with the Xbox One?
No, it's not with the Xbox One, because my other discs are running fine. It's with Assassin's Creed 4. You know, and the problem with Blu-ray discs is that, and HD discs, is that the information is so more compressed on it that there's a lot more chances for errors. I mean, I had to put it in 3 or 4 times before it actually recognized it.
But there's the option to do it
with other discs.
There's the option to do a full install, right?
I don't know. I haven't tried that yet. You know, but I mean, people, it's at some point. You know, I don't know. What do you think, Jordan?
Okay, so first off, the rumor of a discless-based system goes all the way back to the original Xbox, where they were talking about doing a set-top box.
It was a rumor. The
Xbox One One. I forget what it was called, the Home Media Version Center or something. There was the same rumor resurfaced with the Xbox 360. None of these rumors were ever true. I can see Microsoft maybe postulating it. I don't see it ever coming to market. A white Xbox One? Absolutely,
almost
will
definitely
be out. Yeah. Almost certainly will be out. I don't think it'll be a discless version. As to the other rumors, a Halo 2 anniversary edition makes perfect sense. Wouldn't be surprised at all to see it on the anniversary of Halo 2. The other part of the rumor is that it is to have a reworked ending, which would make me happier.
But wait a minute. If they release Halo 2, you know, anniversary edition for the Xbox One, does that mean they're going to release a Halo Anniversary Edition for the Xbox One, too?
I doubt it, because they just had the Anniversary Edition come out.
Yeah, but the Xbox One version.
I mean, Yeah, that's true, because Halo is not, the original Halo is not currently playable on the Xbox One.
Well, here's the thing. How are they going to release a Halo 1, 2, 3 bundle if they don't have, you know, if they don't have them all in the same format?
Yeah, that's true. It would be nice to be able to play all the Halo games on the same platform on the Xbox One.
Well, I mean, imagine if they
from
they
1 actually, to 5.
Imagine if they actually strung all three of them together so that, you know, it's one continuous story.
It would be interesting. It would be interesting to see. I wouldn't mind seeing that. I haven't heard any rumors about Halo 3, you know, Anniversary Edition or otherwise, but yeah, as far as a diskless system goes, I think it would be a disaster. I don't think so. If
what about a 1 terabyte Xbox One for next holiday?
Oh yeah, a one terabyte for next holiday makes perfect sense as well, because particularly if they want to do diskless, because you need the space to store all this stuff. But if you go back to the last generation, it seems weird to be talking about Xbox 360 and PS3 as last generation already. But if you go back to the last generation, you look at the complaints people had about the PS3. The number one complaint was every time I turn around, it's doing an update or of some kind or another, right? If somebody wants to play a game, are they really going to wait 48 hours for it to finish downloading? Because that's what it's going to take with current American download speeds to be able to get a game like Titanfall on the Xbox One. It's going to take a 2-day download if you want to do it all digitally. I don't think people are willing to wait.
Yeah, I've said it before. People aren't ready to wait. Not everybody yes, people have internet speeds much faster than they did 10 years ago, but they're still not up to this, you know, to these demands, like Jordan is pointing out.
I don't know if it's going to take that long.
Yeah, maybe it won't take that long for people living in major cities. Maybe it won't take that long for people who really prioritize their internet access over other bills.
Well, that's just it. A full Blu-ray game is like 50 gigs.
Well, here's the thing. Well, that's not necessarily true, Jordan. Remember, they have to repeat data on the disk over and over and over again. When you install something, you know, it's usually more like 12 to 15 gigabytes. But they weren't saying that this would replace the Xbox One. This would just be one that would be sold side by side, you know, as sort of like the lower priced, disk drive less version. Right. Which is just for, you know, digital and digital only. But if you're going to do that, you need a 1 terabyte. 500 gigabytes is not going to cut it.
500 gigabytes won't be anywhere near enough. And I think if they really want to split the marketplace, right, and have a different version that's cheaper, then the number one way to do that is to just cut the Kinect and take the $100 off and have your $399 version of the Xbox One and
be
done with it.
That's not going to happen because the developers have to know that every single system is the same and every single system is going to have a Kinect.
You know? And the games that you actually make functional use of the Kinect.
Like Dead Rising 3. Have you played Dead Rising 3? Have you seen
the Kinect games? I have played Dead Rising 3 and the Kinect functionality is almost non-existent. I would not know that it had Kinect functionality.
Not even when the zombies grab you and you have to wave your arm to get knock them off?
No,
scream out those words at the bosses.
I have not noticed any requirement to use the Kinect at all on the Xbox One.
Well, do you have your Kinect on? Because
I have the Kinect on, and I can't say that I ever actually use.
Well, have you used Smart Glass with Dead Rising 3? Because
I've tried. I did fire up Smart Glass, and that was interesting. The Smart Glass actually was more functional than the Kinect for Dead Rising.
I mean, it's more involved because you get more missions that way, you know?
Correct.
He calls you up. He says, oh, by the way, there's something over here if you want to.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, to be perfectly honest, I have not found Dead Rising 3 to be very compelling. And I've logged maybe 2 hours on it and haven't really gone back to it.
You know what I would like to do is I'd like to do co-op with you because there's co-op in the game.
Well, co-op would require me to have Xbox Live Gold, which I still have not sprung for. I'm still waiting for...
Wait. Didn't you have the...
I have a three-month card. I haven't found a compelling reason to activate it yet. So.
Well, co-op with me. That's a compelling reason. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, okay. Scrolling. Nintendo cuts overhead in executive salaries, and this comes to us from Games Industry Biz.
Okay, stop for a second. By the way, Jordan, I know about your story, but you can just discuss it after Paul does.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, sure. So you can just incorporate it. Okay, go ahead, Paul.
Okay. Nintendo President Shigeru Iwata will slash his salary by 50% following the publication of Nintendo's nine-month financial results. According to a report from AFP, while Nintendo had warned investors of its drastically revised estimates earlier in the month, its nine-month report published today confirmed the disappointing performance of the Wii U over the holiday period. As a result, Iwata will take a 50% reduction in pay for the next 5 months, a period that will see Nintendo's balance sheet return to the red for its full-year results. And Iwata will not be alone. According to Siliconeria, okay, you know what? You gave me the story with all the Japanese names in it. I think I'm
that's
doing
not
pretty
a Japanese
well.
Name. That's,
I'm just
that's,
saying.
That's a Western
I think I'm doing pretty well so far.
You're holding it together.
I say that because watch me butcher the rest of this. Shigeru Miyamoto, Genyo Tadika, both representative directors at Nintendo, will have their salaries cut by 30%, while the remaining directors will all have their pay reduced by 20%. Nintendo's executives also took a pay cut during the 3DS's initial struggles. However, it remains to be seen whether the company can rescue the fortunes of the Wii U in the same manner.
But you see, you did Miyamoto's name perfectly, so.
Well, of course. He's one of the most brilliant game designers who ever lived.
Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting that all they had to do is cut a little overhead and they would be back in the black. Although I find that hard to believe.
I now wish to buy stock in Nintendo, knowing how their leadership takes responsibility, personal responsibility for their business, unlike so many other businesses in so many other industries.
That's absolutely true. And you know, the fact that they did this when the 3DS didn't really catch fire, right? And they corrected their action by cutting the price, and the 3DS, you know, blossomed after that.
Well, that's just the point, though. I mean, if they're going to cut overhead, are they also going to cut the price of the Wii U? Is the question? That's
what I'm expecting to happen.
Well, the price of hardware always drops after the first year, so it's right. Coming.
Yeah, but how much is the question?
That's true.
So, Paul, I mean, not Paul, I mean, Jordan also has a little bit of a follow up that was released earlier today.
Yeah, a couple of days ago, Nintendo also announced that in addition to the salary cuts, they have stated that they are now open to the idea of mergers and acquisitions, and they're also open to the idea of withdrawing from the stock market. Sorry, Paul, if you want stock, better buy it quick. that the idea that, you know, projecting sales forward is something that they're not very good at, and they're admitting that they're not very good at it. And because they're not good at it, that ends up hurting their stock price. Maybe it might be better to not be in the stock market at all, which would be involve, you know, buying a lot of their stock back and taking the company private again, which can be done. Other companies have done it quite successfully. Other companies, not so much. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with this. If they do actually merge or acquire, and the interesting part is that when they talk about mergers and acquisitions, it's not solely being acquired by somebody else or purchase. It's also the idea of purchasing someone else.
Usually Iwata, for some kind of specific niche talent that you don't have, in the way that Disney bought social game expert Playdom.
Last week they were talking about the mobile space, right? And you have to wonder if that might be part of it, if they're going to acquire somebody to help them go into the mobile space.
That would be interesting if they went after a handset carrier to develop a Nintendo handset or partner with a handset carrier. The other thing that I think would be fascinating is what they mentioned is branching out into the healthcare industry, which I thought was strange.
They had the little heartbeat monitor.
But you know, one of Sony's most profitable divisions is insurance. So you know, and
Nintendo,
you know,
insurance. Instead of having the Aflac duck, you have Mario.
Well, having an industry segment that is not tied to technology, that is not subject to the vagaries of technology going up and down, up and down, and up and down, makes a certain amount of solid financial sense. So,
no, because Nintendo, if they're not video games, they just did playing cards, you know.
Well, yeah, exactly. They did playing cards for 100 years, but you know, having something that can keep money coming into the company, you know, regardless of whether, you know, people like your console or not, is a good idea.
False.
So it's all speculation at this point. I think it's fascinating. I mean,
that was an instruction to Paul. Paul, go ahead and speculate.
Oh, I really don't have a speculation.
Okay, well then just say what's on your mind.
Oh, Nintendo's going to be just fine. Don't worry about them.
Okay.
My prediction is a partnership with Disney. That's my prediction.
Oh my God.
You will see Nintendo characters integrated into Disney/Marvel/Star Wars/ you know, that whole Disney conglomeration.
Well, you know, there was someone who was conspicuously absent from Wreck-It Ralph, you know.
Mario was not in Wreck-It Ralph. That's correct.
Yeah, I mean they had Sonic, but not
well, and
any other.
Fix-It Felix was by and large a pastiche of Mario, and Wreck-It Ralph was a pastiche of Donkey Kong.
No, you know, I think it was more like it was less like Mario's games, and more in the mold of games like Crazy Climber and all that. You know.
Well, that's true. Or yeah. Minor 2049er.
Yeah. Well. Maybe not that, but you know, it didn't strike me as very well. I guess when you have Ralph in the role of a Donkey Kong type character, but I never really saw it that way. It was too Western.
Yeah.
You know,
Minor 2049er. There's a gaming flashback for you.
We did that one a long time ago.
Yeah.
9 levels. Yes. So we're gonna move on to the next item. I believe this is me.
Paul hasn't really had one. Give this one to Paul.
I just did one.
He just did this one. What are you talking about?
I did the Nintendo one.
Okay.
Square Enix responds to Final Fantasy 15 and Kingdom Hearts 3 launch rumor from Silicon Valley. What?
Sorry.
Paul's head exploded. It's okay.
You may have heard about a document from Square Enix Europe that pegs Final Fantasy 15 and Kingdom Hearts 3 for release in 2014. In a statement sent to Silicon Era, Square Enix says the release schedule is inaccurate. We're aware that an internal document has been in circulation listing release dates for select Square Enix titles. The information contained in this document is inaccurate and features placeholder timing. Specifically, no announcement has been made for Kingdom Hearts 3 and Final Fantasy 15. Their projected release window remains to be advised.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Final Fantasy 15 and Kingdom Hearts 3 were revealed at E3 2013 as titles in development for the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. Yeah.
See, now that's a reason to buy new hardware.
There you go.
Well, I mean Kingdom Hearts. The hell with Final Fantasy at this point. They fucked it up too bad.
Well, let's hear more about that. Why do you think they screwed it up? As if we didn't already know. Although, I will say this. People are very happy now with Final Fantasy XIV: A Realm Reborn. But I know you don't care about MMOs that much.
Yeah, I'm not really a big fan of MMOs to begin with.
It's Final Fantasy XIII that you're upset with.
Yeah, it's, you know what, they kind of forgot somewhere along the line, as you know, that story really is gameplay's bitch.
Yeah, but you know what,
and if you can't figure out how to get where you're going or do what you want to do, then the game's just going to be terrible.
Well, they have a third attempt at Final Fantasy 13 coming, you know, with Lightning Returns.
Yeah, there comes a certain point where you just cut bait and keep moving.
Well, you know, the thing is that Lightning Returns is so different from the other two games. It's no longer narrow corridors. You know, now you explore cities. You know, it's more like a Final Fantasy game. I can't speak for the story because, you know, who knows? But it's a lot different than the first two games.
13 had the opposite problem of not knowing where to go. There was only one way to go, and it was in a straight line over and over and over again.
30 levels were boring. You didn't do anything.
Yeah.
So,
although I did like the guy with the bird living in his hair.
Yeah, you know, they should have I wonder if they should make a Tamagotchi-like game with chocobos, or did they do that already?
I think they've done that.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It wouldn't surprise me. Yeah, it probably never made it to the United States, but it wouldn't surprise me if it exists.
So, Kingdom Hearts 3.
They're doing a 1 and 2 HD remix thing as well, aren't they? Or a 1.5 and a 2.5.
Oh my God, I'm so tired of those things.
Handheld games. They did a compilation of Kingdom Hearts 1 and the two handheld games. I know that. The thing is that this is actually going to be the first time they're doing something that's actually moving the story forward. I know that Paul's complaint was, stop doing the same thing over. Just give me something new.
oh my god, like, just take me to new goddamn worlds already. Let me run around and hit things with my sword and we'll all be happy.
Well, you know what? I'm willing to bet you Tiana will be there.
Oh, that'd be nice.
Wreck-It Ralph will probably be there.
That'd be nice.
Who else?
See, that's fascinating, because now that Marvel has all these companies, they could integrate Marvel characters.
I don't know if Marvel's going to be a part of it. It's not a, you know, it's
Star Wars characters.
You might as well say Star Wars will be in it.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. It's not so much that Disney owns all of these characters and they could just kind of shove them in willy-nilly. Kingdom Hearts as a franchise licenses those characters by Squaresoft from Disney. Well, so they have to pay individually for each individual character or set of characters that they use. And additionally, they have to pay for Disney's voice actors anytime they want those characters to speak, because, you know, Disney character voices is very specific guidelines. Only, you know, a handful of actors for each voice are approved. So you can't just have someone who doesn't sound like Mickey if you want to have Mickey talking in your game.
You know,
doesn't
I think it's going to be
Final Fantasy or Mickey's Magical Quest, you know?
I think they'll just stick with what you might expect in Disneyland, you know?
I just want to see Darth Vader and Maleficent in the same game.
Well, you have a Maleficent live action movie coming, so.
I know.
It seems they're trying to do for that what they did with Wicked, you know?
Right.
So.
Wicked started as a book. And then was a stage play, and then
very long and boring book about the nature of good and evil.
Yeah.
Well,
five different religions going around in Oz.
Well, fortunately, Stephen Schwartz is a friend of mine, and actually, you know, I actually helped him with Wicked, I helped him with research on whether that glowing bubble that Glinda arrived in was ever mentioned outside of the film, because the thing is they couldn't deal with the film. They had to avoid, you know, things that were exclusive to the film. They had to use things that were a part of the series outside of the film as well.
Right. I mean, that's why the Broadway play, she doesn't actually ever sit on the broom, or she doesn't, you know, her hat's got that weird slope in it, because they had to make it different from the MGM property.
Yeah.
And MGM differed greatly from the original books too. In fact, the original slippers were not ruby slippers; they were silver slippers.
And they also silver the Kildare, the Kildares, you know, those tiger creatures that they had to deal with.
Yeah.
And also, doesn't the Wicked Witch in the books actually die like 40% of the way through, and of the journey is Dorothy getting back to the Emerald City?
And they had to combine both witches.
Correct.
Witches.
Yeah.
And Glinda isn't the Good Witch of the North. She's the Witch of the South, and she's very seldom in the series. Like, she makes one grand appearance,
barely see her. Yeah.
Just kind of walks away.
You know what? When they're doing the Yellow the Brick Road song, you notice that the other road is red because that leads to the South. You know, they at least kept that in.
Right.
Well, that's neat. As a kid, I always did wonder where that other road went.
Yeah, it was going to the South.
They made it look like that.
It was leading to, not Glinda's, but, you know, the real Glinda's, you know, it was leading to the land of the South. I mean, that was part of it, you know, so that's why, you know, the Yellow Road and also the Red Road was going south into South. That was actually a little bit of a nod to the book.
Yeah, that's a neat fact.
Yeah.
Nice to know that it actually did go somewhere.
Yeah, well, what do you think? It just went nowhere?
No, it could have just been a bit of set dressing, just something to offset the yellow for film.
Well, it did, but that wasn't just it, you know. Oh, and by the only reason why they went with ruby slippers was that silver slippers looked
better.
Yeah, silver slippers looked better and didn't look good in color, and they wanted the whole color Technicolor pop, which is perfectly understandable.
I have the original Franco, well, not the original, but I have the books that were released back in the 80s, and they were silver slippers. I wonder if they ever changed it at any point in the books to ruby.
Yeah, because the books were published like two generations before the movie.
By the way, Saving Mr.
Early 1900s as opposed to 1930s.
You know, by the way, Saving Mr. Banks is one big lie. Marielle Travers never, ever liked the movie, ever. She never, ever liked it.
Oh, well, they cut off before the fact that she, you know, insists on changes after it had already premiered. You know, the movie just kind of ends before that. She may have found things about it redeeming, but she'd already signed the papers.
No, she never even thought that. She hated it all the way through.
One plug I'd like to do, as long as we're talking about the Oz books, I picked up the Marvel adaptations of the Oz books for my wife for Christmas.
Oh,
and they're
what about the What about the Marvel DC co-production for the movie book?
For the movie book. These are actually adaptations of the first five or six original books, written by Eric Schanauer and illustrated by Scotty Young, and they're absolutely gorgeous, every single one of them.
That reminds me, I have to do a plug for System Mechanic before this podcast ends. Anyway,
I like how it's like the week of the Olympics, and we haven't talked about my game yet.
We talk about your game at the end of every podcast, Paul. You're there. You're right. We're right on the top of everything to do with Pinsanity. I am totally serious.
Oh my God! Have you seen my favorite pin yet?
I even know the name Pinsanity. How about that?
I'm impressed. Do you know what my favorite pin is yet?
No.
I do not know what your favorite pin is yet, Brian, because you have not been on the podcast to talk about your favorite pin yet.
I have a favorite pin.
We can talk about it at the end of the show. Okay, so we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Jordan.
Razer to give Xbox One gamers more peripheral options. This comes to us from Tom's Hardware. Popular peripheral maker Razer announced on Thursday that it has teamed up with Microsoft to develop new products for the just-launched Xbox One console. I don't know if we can say just-launched. For the Xbox One console.
Hey, wait. It's February. I mean, it launched in November. It's still technically that just launched. It's 3 months.
This new suite will include a controller, arcade stick, and more. Just weeks ago, the company introduced its Razer Nabu, a smart wristband that delivers notifications from a smartphone right to the user's wrist and tracks selected personal information. Data is displayed by two OLED notification screens, one of which resides on the bottom facing the user, keeping all information shielded from the eyes of everyone else. Additional details about Razer's partnership with Microsoft. Unlike the Kinect. Additional details about Razer's partnership with Microsoft will be revealed in the coming weeks.
I bring this up because now neither the PlayStation 4 nor the Xbox One have their third-party hardware yet, really.
That's true, and no third-party hardware. I like the idea of an arcade stick coming out. That could make fighting games interesting. It'd be interesting to have a good fighting game to actually use an arcade stick on. Mm-hmm. Instead of Killer Instinct, but if we get a Tekken or a Virtua Fighter or something later on down the road, we'll see.
Now the thing is that it also went on to the Sabretooth for the Xbox 360, which had hyper response buttons, but that's last gen. The reason why I find it interesting is I really want my headphones. You know, I want headphones that allow me to listen to my game without annoying everybody else, you know, and also block out the world. Third party is very important.
That's true. And the headphone plug on the bottom of the Xbox One controller is very unique and distinct. Mm. So, there needs to be something that plugs in there.
And I'd be interested to see what Sony's doing. I mean, I think Sony has a relationship with Logitech, don't they?
Sony, on the bottom of the controller, just has a standard headphone jack, so you can plug in any kind of headphones you want.
Yeah, but you can't use the special, like Turtle Beach stuff.
You can't use the special Turtle Beach stuff. But I mean, if
that's
you have
like
a regular wired,
they have that for the
cell phone headset.
I'm not worried about that. I'm talking about the Turtle Beach stuff, or the everybody hates Turtle Beach.
Everybody hates Turtle Beach because the signal they were running on the 360 overlaid with the signal of the controllers and screwed things up. But
I'm just saying about Titan. Let's talk about Titan. Those sort of things. In which you have the high end. The thing is that people were a little bit annoyed because they didn't even have an adapter for their old gen stuff to work on the Xbox One, so they had to wait. And Microsoft said, listen, instead of forcing something out, we're just wait until we get this perfected and we'll release it.
What I really want is a media remote, because playing DVDs and playing Blu-rays on a system using only the controller pretty much blows. I want an actual remote control, guys.
Hmm. Okay, we're going to move on to gaming history. Okay, Paul, take this away.
Scrolling. Black Isle Studios, and this comes from our game history section. Black Isle Studios was and is a division of the computer and video game developer and publisher Interplay Entertainment. Black Isle was based in Orange County, California, USA, formed in 1996, adopting the name Black Isle Studios in 1998. The idea for the division's name came from the Black Isle in Scotland, founder Fergus Urquhart's native country. Come on, that was pretty good.
Yeah, well, Urquhart. But if you ever watched Local Hero a lot, then you'd know that. Gordon Urquhart.
Yeah.
Did a good job.
Black Isle Studios was most famous for working on the first two games of the popular and influential Fallout series, as well as the critically acclaimed Planescape Tournament. They also achieved success with the Icewind Dale and Baldur's Gate series of role-playing video games, though they only published the Baldur's Gate series. Well, you know, lucky for them in the long run. The studio, although created... for the creation of Fallout the studio, although credited for the creation of Fallout, was in fact not responsible for the game, but rather a key portion of the original studio came from the team that made Fallout when developing Fallout 2, the studio's first official game. Several employees left Interplay to form Trochia Games after they were, quote, unable to come to an agreement with Interplay as to how their next team should be structured. The remaining team would go on to release such critically acclaimed games as Fallout 2, Planescape Tournament, Icewind Dale, and produce the critically acclaimed Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2 Shadow of the Amin, in conjunction with BioWare. In 1999, IGN's RPG Vault gave it the award for Developer of the Year. In the years leading to the closure of Black Isle, Interplay's financial difficulties would worsen, leading for the team to cancel anticipated games such as Black Isle's Torn and Stonekeep 2 Godmaker, releasing only Icewind Dale 2, publishing Lionheart Legacy and The Crusader, and developing Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance 2. On December 8th of 2003, in the midst of serious financial difficulties, Interplay laid off the entire Black Isle studio staff, which also resulted in the cancellation of Baldur's Gate 3, The Black Hound, Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance 3, and the original Fallout 3. In August of 2012, Interplay, after releasing MDK2 Heart HD on Steam, would revive the studio with the motto, "Our goal has always been to make the world's greatest RPGs," and the slogan, Black Isle is back. The new studio has been stated to be thoroughly focused on creating innovative RPGs like its predecessor. Both ex-Black Isle employees Chris Avalon of Obsidian Entertainment and former Interplay CEO Brian Fargo in Exile Entertainment commented that they knew nothing about the reopening of the studio before the announcement. Avondale denied any involvement of Obsidian in the revival. Speculation went awry with the revival, with some speculating that Interplay had once again gotten a Dungeons & Dragons license. Others stating then, which was, you know, what they used for Baldur's Gate, others stating that the team would co-opt Baldur's Gate Enhanced Edition with Overhaul Games, and some that the team would merge with Overhaul's parent company, Beamdog. However, Overhaul was quick to deny involvement with the new Black Isle Studios. Only two members of the original Black Isle Studio, not to be confused with Chris Tyler of Gas-Powered Games.
What? You just skipped an entire thing. Try that again. Only two members from the original?
Lineblock, sorry. Only two members of the original Black Isle team are working on the new team, and they are Mark O'Green and Chris Tyler, who is the head of the studio, not to be confused with Chris Tyler of Gas-Powered Games. The new Black Isle's name... game announced is Project V13 to help get funding for the game through Invested IN. They launched a crowdsourced fundraiser called the Black Isle Mayan Apocalypse Replacement Program.
Yeah.
That was a long piece.
Well, I mean, no, which one of you's played the classic Black Isle games like Icewind Dale or Baldur's Gate?
I played Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 and Baldur's Gate 2 on the iMac way, way, way back in the day.
How about you, Paul?
No, I haven't played any of them.
Really? That's interesting. I never even knew there was a Baldur's Gate 3, to tell you the truth. But it's interesting that neither Chris Avalon or Brian Fargo even learned about this. Can you imagine their shock? Oh wait, the company that we started is starting up again without our involvement. You know.
Well, yeah. I mean, if they sold it, it doesn't really matter if they're involved or not.
Yeah, but you know, it's sort of like it was dead for the past 9 years, and all of a sudden it's like resurrected, like a ghost. You know, like a zombie. It's like, what? Wait.
It does seem strange to just kind of bring it back. It you know, for in terms of pure name recognition, it'd be nice to involve them, but I don't think it's absolutely necessary.
They do have
necessary.
Two guys from the original team.
Yeah.
I mean, and we know the travails of Interplay in the past few years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I think they needed a name.
Yeah, I like the first two Fallout games, even though I'm known for despising point and click RPGs, because it doesn't feel like you're controlling a character. It feels like you're pointing around on a map. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people do like that style of game. What I would like to see happen has absolutely nothing to do with any of this. But talking about the D&D license, I'd like to see modern remakes of the classic gold box D&D games. The Curse of the Azure Bonds and yeah, all of those.
Pools of Darkness was the last one.
Yeah.
I just started playing Planescape Torment. I'm very early in the game. As a matter of fact, I bought it way back when, and I started it. I never finished it. I never even continued it. And now I've decided I bought it on good old games, and now I'm gonna play it, because apparently, you know, all your, like most BioWare / Black Isle games, all your choices have an effect on the game. You know, so I'm gonna try that. I'm starting that again. Anyways, our question of the week is related to the gaming flashback. What was the best game you played that you felt was unfinished? Go ahead, Paul.
This was easy. This would be Twilight Princess.
Okay.
Yeah, why? Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess. You get to the last dungeon where Ganon's living, and you walk across this one bridge in this room where there are clearly spaces for like five other hallways that are just like bricked over. And the dungeon, like the dungeon itself, just, you know, you only need to use like one or two of the myriad of weapons that you collect all along the way. And just knowing that this, you know, one of the signature features of the Zelda franchise is that you do kind of need everything in order to get to Ganon at the end. I just walked through that one room and it was like, man, it was really easy to see where they cut stuff.
So, you know, sort of like Simon's Quest, in which you walk through, you know, Castlevania 2, Simon's Quest, in which you get to Death, and you can just walk by him without having to fight him. When in the first game, he was supposed to be a real bitch to try and kill, you know. How about you, Jordan?
I think the best game that, as a rule, I don't think games that feel unfinished qualify for the best category, first off. But
what's the best game despite being unfinished?
Despite being unfinished.
Well, feeling unfinished. It's not that it's unfinished. It just feels like you feel like there's something missing, that, you know, like there should have been something there, but isn't.
Right.
You know?
Journey on the PlayStation 3. And I think it's only on the PlayStation 3.
Only on the PlayStation. Well, actually, I think you can play it on the Vita.
I don't know.
Play it on the Vita, I'm pretty sure.
It's an absolutely gorgeous game, and it has this real ethereal quality. No, it's in fact it's all game. There's absolutely no narrative whatsoever. They do not explain anything, and it feels like there's supposed to be a story, but at the end of the game, you walk away from it going, "What the hell was that?" You know, it really, you know, if I'd paid full price for it, I would have been greatly disappointed. But, you know, it feels like it should be so much more. There's potential for it to be so much more. But it feels like, okay, we have a world, we have a basic gameplay mechanic, we'll just release it like that. We don't need to bother with any kind of story mode or any kind of explanation or plot or anything. Just here you are, let's release it to the world. It feels like basically one third of a game.
I think this category could also be called anything ever done by Peter Molyneux. But, you know, I'm gonna pick one that I know Paul's probably gonna get upset over. And of the games that Peter Molyneux made that felt unfinished, to me it was Dungeon Keeper. Because I knew what Dungeon Keeper was supposed to be, and then he turned it into just theme park with monsters. Not that there's anything wrong with theme park with monsters, But it was supposed to be you would create a dungeon, your friends would be heroes trying to invade that dungeon. You know, sort of like you were the DM and you created this horrible filled dungeon, and then people would try to get through it, you know. But it never appeared that – it never turned into that. All it then turned into was theme park or theme hospital with monsters. And it was a very good game, but I felt like this could have been so much more. You know,
I need to send you a link because there's been recent complaints about the iOS version of Dungeon Keeper being free to play, and how if you want to
hold on, iOS Dungeon Keeper, we say hold on.
You can immediately go to
what
you
have to save yourselves, boys.
iOS and the Google Play version apparently is free to play, and if you want to dig out a room or something like that, it will come up in the interface and say, okay, yeah, we'll dig out that room for you. It's going to take 24 hours unless you want to spend some gems on it, and here's our gem purchase selection screen. Yeah,
I'd just rather get the Abandonware version of the game, thank you.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it really kind of starts to irritate me when people when players expect the entire game for free. It's like, did you forget that other people make their living making these things for you? It's like you wouldn't walk into a movie theater expecting to see the film for free.
No, but you can buy the original game on Good Old Games for, you know, $5, and you know, having a quote unquote free to play version that is seriously gimped.
It's not even something that works with the genre of the game. I mean, you know, right. I mean, this is supposed to be a real-time strategy game. It's not real-time strategy if you have to stop and wait 24 hours just to have a room excavation come out. Especially right. when in that game, you know, you find yourself changing the room on the fly, you know, because, oh, darn, this isn't going to work. I have to do this or I have to do that. You know this better than I do, Paul. It's a game in which you have to be quick on your feet. You know, it's like very slow. And damn, I forgot to do this and this and this. You know, and now the horned demon is getting upset.
Would you rather that there was a $50 version?
It's never going to be $50. It wasn't even $50 when it first came out, Paul. Come on. It's like $2 or $3 on Good Old Games, I'm pretty sure. You know? Here's the thing.
You're dismissing the point. Would you prefer a fully paid version?
Well, I don't need it because there's a free version on Facebook called Dungeon Overlord if I wanted to play it that way. And it has a much better monetary system. Again,
you're expecting the full game for free, forgetting the fact that people have to make their living and feed themselves by doing this work professionally full time.
I
think there has to be a middle ground between free game and free to play game where the top gem package is. I think that they mentioned in the review it is $64.99. for 14,000 gems,
I'd rather pay for a game than get it for free. To tell you the truth, I mean, there's a lot of backlash against free to play games. People don't want to play free.
Oh, I agree. I prefer to pay for my games up front too. But there's an additional mindset,
you know. And Facebook has a great amount of free games that have monetization that don't act like that, and I'm not thinking about Candy Crush either. I'm thinking about games like that Scrabble simulation, you know, that Scrabble analog they have, or even Plants vs. Zombies on Facebook is better.
Yeah, well, I'm not talking about specific examples of, you know, when a game does it well and when a game does it poorly. I'm talking about the overall expectation of what one gets for free.
Well, here's the thing, Paul. If no one even downloads your game and plays it because they don't like your system, you're not going to make money that way, even if it's free. I mean, that's just...
Please don't patronize me.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying if you know, people can feel like they're like something is overpriced when it's free. And just say, won't buy it.
I'm going to link you guys to the article that I read, and maybe we can discuss this next week. It might be a fit topic for discussion. I found the article absolutely fascinating. And as points of comparison, there's a video of the original Dungeon Keeper, and then there's also the same guy doing a review of the new free-to-play version with in-app purchases and stuff like that. The title of the article is How In-App Purchases Has Destroyed the Industry.
You know, the thing is that I finally got my iPad to allow me to buy in-app purchases because I finally got to buy the expansion to Pandemic. I'm a little disappointed because it doesn't have the additional game mode, but I do like the extra cards and rolls. So we're gonna move on. We don't have any reader feedback, but you heard the question of the week, and the question of the week, as I said before, is what was the best game that you played that you felt was unfinished? Now, I'm going to talk about System Mechanic, which is sort of like an advertisement, you know. And actually, it's a review that I use System Mechanic. Do either of you know about System Mechanic?
No.
Okay. Well, it's something that people who have AOL are familiar with because they keep on getting the AOL will offer this. System Mechanic is an optimization software. You know, it's basically for tuning up your PC. And it's the one I've been using for the past couple of years. And they now have the 12.5 version. And it has something. It has stuff like Live Boost Tech. Now, get this. One of the things I love using is the CRUD remover. You know, the CRUD remover removes all the duplicate stuff from your system. You know, those background software, and keeps them out of the way. You know, they have something new called OptiCore, in which it'll save CPU resources until it needs it. And same thing with Ramjet. And, you know, it's really nifty, and it's really, you know, it's not very intrusive, you know. And the thing is that I never really have my computer slowing down anymore with it, you know.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, so it also has a great disk optimization. You know, it optimizes not only your disk drive, but it optimizes your, what do they call it again? Your system files?
Registry.
Your registry, yeah. It optimizes registry. It optimizes everything, you know. And now the 12.5 version has it so that it actually monitors your computer without taking up any memory space, and makes it so that it's at its fastest, you know. So, I mean, if you want to check out System Mechanic, go ahead. It's from ILO, IOLO.com. So, you know, go ahead and check it out. System Mechanic 12.5 is the new version. And basically, you can buy the base software. They also have a subscription that you can get into that unlocks other things. I know that sounds, it's actually pretty cool. So, look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast, or the forums at gamingpodcast.net/forum, or send us comments to fans@gamingpodcast.net. You can also check out our gaming news at gamestudios.com, and look for Paul's new game, Team USA's Pinsanity, now on Facebook. And as a bonus, he's finally going to tell us what his favorite pin is. Go ahead.
My personal favorite pin, and this is just a matter of my own personal opinion, is the Rainbow Team USA pin.
Okay.
I did not see this one coming.
Wow. That sounds like a big deal there, Paul.
Yeah, and actually it is kind of a big deal. It is a Team USA logo laid over the six colors of a rainbow flag. Very tasteful, and I'm really proud of it.
I'm pretty sure it's Vladimir Putin's favorite pin.
Hard currency exclusive, but we usually do give you more than enough hard currency to start off with to buy it if you want to go take a look at it. Oh yeah, it's my favorite pin. Oh, and we just launched our first limited edition pin set, by the way. Only 1,000 of each design.
Wow.
Yeah.
And are these virtual pins?
These are virtual pins, but you know, hey, if the game proves popular enough, there has been talk of making them into real world items.
I mean, if you have pins, you know, I would rather have a physical pin, you know, than actually just a virtual pin. And it's one of those things in which you want.
But speaking of physical properties, we have been running a contest every single week where a different pin of the week has been picked. And every time you acquire one in any way through the game, whether it's, you know, spinning or trading or redeeming a code or whatever, you're entered into a contest to win real world Team USA merchandise.
Cool. So anyways, that's our podcast. Glad Paul is back for this episode. I don't know if he's going to be back again, but, you know.
God, the Olympics start on Friday. I'm going to lose my mind. With so much content to be done, like within 10 hours of something cool happening in Russia, that, like, I'm going to be sleeping at the office for, like, the next 2 weeks.
And, no. Well, and the time difference, right? So, you know, stuff is going on in Russia. You're going to find out about it as it happens, I expect. And then there will be a delay before it's actually aired in the United States. You might be under a time crunch to get a pin by U.S. airtime.
Yeah, well, these are all production things that we've talked about, you know, being absolutely responsive. We would love it for players and, you know, Olympic spectators to come to our game to help celebrate with Team USA. You know, all of the revenue taken in by the game goes directly to support our Olympic athletes.
And you need like a pin for every medal win, right? You know, somebody wins a gold medal, you make a pin for that event and that athlete.
Well, there are absolutely plans like that in place where we're going to celebrate the real achievements going on in Russia. I'm not going to boast about the timeline, but we're hoping to do it, you know, in relevant timeframes. You know, hopefully, you know, we win the gold in a particular event and we'll have a pin celebrating it hopefully within 24 hours.
And then you run into the gag of NBC complaining that you're announcing who the winners are too early. So that then there's a nightmare there. Oh, my gosh. I feel so sorry for you, Paul.
Well, like I said, you know, it's all about working with Team USA's partners to develop content with relevant timelines.
Yeah, right, right.
We need at some point another little outtakes episode in which you, Paul, and Jennifer discuss whatever.
Why? Mrs. Lund's not available?
She's available.
You're not available, Paul.
Yeah, yeah. You're not available, Paul.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Jordan and Jennifer talking amongst each other, that's not quite as entertaining as the three of you talking.
Nothing's ever as entertaining as it is when I'm involved.
She has recently lost her job, so she is available whenever you would like to talk.
Talk now. And everybody go buy a Rainbow Team USA pin so that maybe they'll make it for real.
Or have Dan with the entire thing. You know, Dan, by the way, said that he got a message from me last week that I sent him on Skype. It's really weird.
It wasn't me. I don't have Skype on except when I need to, like for the show.
Yeah. Same here.
Anyways, thanks for coming on, Paul, and we'll see you guys next week.
See you guys next week.
Bye, Bonds.